I also want to thank Damien for inviting me to come and speak when he heard that I was coming to Paris to visit a friend. He took the opportunity to invite me to speak, and I really appreciate that opportunity. But actually, I really want to thank him for what he's doing for restoring the understanding of the French liberal tradition. There is a French liberal tradition, which I think many French people would not realise. They think this is sort of Anglo-American cultural imperialism. And so one of the most important things, I believe, for French liberals is to rediscover that tradition and inform the French people about the existence of this tradition. And that's one of the things that Damien and the Institut Coppée has been doing an extremely good job on. My institute, we support students who are working on Montesquieu and Tocqueville and Molinari and Bastiat. So we too have a strong belief in the importance of French liberalism. So the fact that I'm not going to mention a French liberal is not an indication that I don't think they're important. It's just, it seems to me, you know a lot more about that than me. It doesn't make a lot of sense for me to talk about French liberalism. So I'm going to talk about the liberalism that I know and am more familiar with. Now the topic, the title of the talk is, what type of libertarian are you? And of course that assumes that you are a libertarian. Now, I hope that you are, but I would say that the questions I want to address are important whatever your particular ideas are. That whether you're a socialist or communist or whatever, you need to engage, or you should engage, I would say, with some of the questions that I want to raise. Now, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the differences between libertarians. That's the theme of my talk. So I do want to begin by making it clear that I think that libertarians do have something in common. And I think what they have in common is the belief that the most important political value is individual liberty. That does not mean it is the most important value. People may put more value, for example, into their family, to their friends, to their religion. We're talking about political values. And it may not be the only political value. So that we may also want to give importance to the concepts of community or solidarity or equality or the rule of law. But it's the most important political value. And sometimes the debate between libertarians is whether it is really the only political value. So they have a lot in common. I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about the differences that they have. And my goal is not to persuade you that one of these schools is correct and the others are wrong. My goal is to get you to think about what your views on these questions are. Do you already know what sort of libertarian you are, or are you still trying to work that out? And one thing I would say is, you're not committed to what you believe today to believe in the rest of your life. That one of the things I believe in is the importance of intellectual humility, that we are learning all the time throughout life. One of the things I know is that some of the things I believe in are wrong. Why do I know that some of the things I believe in are wrong? It's because I'm a human being. And one thing we know about human beings is that they're imperfect in their understanding of the world. So assuming I am a human being, and I hope you'll take that for granted, then there must be something in the views that I hold that are wrong. Indeed, lots of things I've written that now, if I was writing them today, I would write them somewhat differently. My problem is that although I know some of the things I believe in are wrong, I don't know which ones. So all I can do is try and present ideas, see people's reaction, have the discussion, and then try and change my views if I find that I no longer believe in the things that I did. So that's sort of the approach I'm taking. I do have a view on everything, but my goal is not to convince you that my view is the correct view. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at three questions that anyone, regardless of their political ideas, should think about. The first question is, how do we decide what government should do? What's the philosophy or methodology that should determine that question? The second question I want to look at is, why should government be limited? Now, I'm going to assume that there are no fascists and communists in this room. If there are, they can probably ignore everything else I'm going to say. But I assume that there's no one in this room who is a totalitarian, that is, who believes that the state should rule everything. Everyone in this room, I believe, thinks it should be limited. But why do you think the state should be limited? Do you believe it should be limited because of the consequences of its actions? Or do you think it should be limited because the state can impinge on your rights? And the third question, and probably the one that much of the discussion will focus around, is, what is the proper, or what is the legitimate role of government? What should government do? So those are the three big questions. As I said, I think they're relevant whether you're a libertarian or not. And then I'm going to look at five different schools of thought and see what do they think about these questions. And sometimes there's even differences within the school. So as well as the summary here, you can also see at the very back is like a little chart which sort of summarizes what I think is the position that these various thinkers hold on the three big questions. Is there anybody by the chance who didn't get a copy of this who would like one? Yeah? Do you have any spare copies you could give, or are we out of copies? For anybody? Yeah? Anybody want to put their hand up if they did not get a copy of this? Sorry, I should have asked at the beginning. Anybody else? No? C'est tout? Bon. So what I'm going to do is look at these five different schools of thought and their answer to these three big questions. And the first school I want to look at is Milton Friedman and the Chicago School. Probably most of you are already familiar with Milton Friedman, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, wrote lots of both academic books, but also books of a more popular nature. And he also did a TV series called Free to Choose, based on one of those popular books. So his answer to the first question, or the Chicago School answer to the first question, is what's the methodology they use? Is that they pursue an empirical, or what would be called a positive methodology. They're interested in the predictive power of theories. So they say, if we do X, we predict the consequence will be Y. If we raise the minimum wage, we predict that that will increase unemployment. Let's have a look at the empirical evidence to see whether that was true or not. So that's their approach, an approach that, in fact, very common among economists, this empirical positivist methodology. On the second question about why it is that government should be limited, their approach is it so much of debate in politics looks at the failures in the marketplace, and there are failures in the marketplace, and then assume because there is market failure, government should come in and sort it out to correct that market failure. The Chicago School says, yes, there is market failure, but there's also something called government failure. When government action, similar to you get in market failure. So instead of, as so happens most of the time with politicians, they look at imperfect markets and assume perfect government, the Chicago School says, no, we must measure imperfect markets with imperfect government. Look at the two. Is market failure bigger than government failure? Is government failure bigger than market failure? And this is an empirical question. But the Chicago School believes that very often, if not most of the time, government failure is bigger than market failure. And the reason for that is that so many policies, the discussion is about the intentions of a policy and not enough about the consequences of a policy. And even when it's about the consequences, it tends to look narrowly at what those consequences might be. So, for example, to go again back to the minimum wage, the idea of the minimum wage is that it should increase the wages of the poorest workers. Then if you look at the positive intended consequences, you will discover that there are workers who have a higher wage because of the minimum wage. But the Chicago School says you also need to look at the negative unintended consequences of those policies. And they argue that when you do that, you will see that there are a larger number of people who are unemployed, who can't get a job because of the minimum wage, and particularly among those with the least skills. So their approach about why government should be limited is that very often the intentions are good, but the negative unintended consequences are so much bigger than the positive intended consequences. Then when it comes to the third question, what is the legitimate role of the state, I'm going to spend a little bit more time on this, because once we've established that, you can understand, I think, more easier some of the other positions. So the view of the Chicago School about what the role of the state is basically fourfold. Number one, protection. It is the job of the state to protect us from foreign enemies, so we need a defense force. It is the job of the state to protect us from our internal enemies, such as criminals, so we need a police force. So that's the first legitimate role of the state. The second legitimate role of the state arises from the fact that when we live together with other people, we will come into conflict with them. And when we're in conflict with someone, there's a very easy way of resolving that conflict. We can beat the other person up. Presumably, we do not want to live in a society where whenever there's a conflict, it turns to violence. So the Chicago School says we need courts so that when there is a conflict, we can go to some neutral body, so neutral arbitrator, who will then decide, hopefully fairly, between those people in conflict with one another. So that's the second job of the government, to try and provide a peaceful reconciliation of conflict through the courts. The third role of government, and I apologise, I'm not an economist, so the economists may object to the way in which I express this, is the idea that there are some things which the market cannot provide satisfactorily, and therefore the government has to play some sort of role. Economists use one term, the term public goods, which is not the same thing as good for the public, unfortunately. This is an example where economists are destroying the English language. Public goods have two characteristics. They're non-excludable from the benefits if they exist. You can't exclude people from benefiting from it. And they're non-rival. If they exist, it does not mean there's any less for anyone else. the classic case of a public good is defence. So let me give you an example. As I hope you realise, I'm British. I'm very keen to keep my British accent because Americans think you're smarter than you really are. I'm British, but I live in the United States. So supposing I said, I would prefer to be defended by Her Majesty the Queen than by the US military. Why shouldn't I be able to do that? Well, the public goods argument would say, you can't be left to do that. You have to contribute to the defence of the United States. Because you can't exclude me if I'm physically on the ground in the United States. You can't exclude me from being defended by the US military. But also, the fact that you're defending me doesn't mean there's any less of a defence for anyone else. So it's non-excludable, non-rival. If I said I could pick and choose whether I wanted to contribute to the US military, then I wouldn't bother to do it. So they say that this is a case of a public good where you have to force people, the state has to provide it, and you have to be forced to contribute to that. So that's public goods. The second example where it's said that the market doesn't do a very good job is with the problem of negative externalities. That is, you may be engaged in a voluntary transaction between two people and you both of them benefit from that, but at the expense of a third party. A classic case of a negative externality is pollution. I may be selling my goods to someone, but it produces pollution in the river, and that affects people further down on the river. That's a negative externality for those people. Said the market by itself cannot satisfy, overcome that problem of negative externalities. Therefore, the government has to come in and sort it out. So that's the third area where the Chicago School says that the government has a role, the state has a role to deal with public goods, to deal with negative externalities. The fourth area where they say the government has a role is that there are some people in society, we assume, do not have the ability to make decisions on their own behalf. The classic case are children. And I have to say, I actually think that if there's an important research topic for libertarians, it's the question of what the hell do we do with children? Because so much of our discussion is about dealing with rational adults that we think can make decisions about themselves. What do we do about this very large number of people who we consider not capable of looking after themselves? And there may be a role for the state here to protect them against parents that neglect them. So this is the fourth area that the Chicago School says government needs to do something, or at least be prepared to do something, these four areas. Now, none of this is, so this is quite an extensive role. Now, this is sometimes called the social market economy. Although, unfortunately, I don't think this is the same as the German conception of the social market, so that makes it a little bit confusing. But arguing that there is important social roles for the state, but as far as possible, we should try and use market mechanisms to deal with these social problems. So, classic example, Friedman believed that there should be a law that you have to send your children to school, and that the state should ensure that anyone can go to school regardless of their financial situation. But, he said, that doesn't mean that the state has to provide all the schools. You could have a market for schools. All schools could be private, competing for the children. But children have to go, and they have financial support to enable them to go. So this is the Chicago School view about the role of government, the so-called social market economy. The second school I want to have a look at is James Buchanan and the Public Choice School. James Buchanan, another Nobel Prize winner, who is based at George Mason University, which is where my institute is based, and they're associated with this idea of the so-called Public Choice School. So their answer to the first question, how do we decide what the role of government is that they believe in a social contract. And by a social contract, what they mean is that if rational beings got together and had to decide what government they want to create, they would agree on the nature of that institution. It doesn't necessarily mean that a social contract existed historically, but as if people had got together to do this. So they assume that what would happen if we have no state? They assume that we would live in a Hobbesian state of nature. This is coming from the British philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who said if we had no government, life would be nasty, brutish, and short, and not, as one student wrote, nasty, British, and short. So what would happen if we had no state? Then we could do three things. We could produce things. We could steal things. Or we could try and protect the things that we have produced. The Public Choice School says it would be rational for self-interested people to get together and create a state that would protect their lives and property. Because if they didn't need to worry about defending their property, if people were discouraged from stealing, you could have a lot more productive society, a lot more productive economy, you'd have more of a surplus, and that surplus could pay for the state, and everyone would be better off. So they argue that rational beings would agree on a social contract that would protect our life and property. Excuse me one second. What about... Sorry, I would want to... Yeah, thanks. So why do they think government should be limited? Well, the problem is that once you have this social contract limited state, there is a natural tendency for that government to grow. Why is this? Well, they argue that human beings are primarily driven by their own self-interest. What economists would call, again, destroying the English language, utility maximizers. Now, very often in discussion about politics, the assumption is that people in the private sector are driven by their own self-interest. How do we maximize our income and wealth? But people in the political sector, or indeed in the non-profit sector, they are driven by some conception of the common good, what's good for society as a whole. They don't put their self-interest first. And one thing you might notice, this is a very common theme in President Obama's speeches. So, for example, he gives special financial support for students who go and work into the government and non-profit sector, which he does not give to students who will go into the private sector. Well, the Public Choice School says, well, wait a minute. They're all human beings. If we assume that it's a common factor in all human beings, then we should assume it's also true of people in the political realm as in the economic realm. So we should, what they call, deromanticize the state. We should no longer assume that the state is driven by a conception of the common good. We too should see people involved in the state as driven by their own self-interest. The difference is that when we look in the economic realm, the private realm, we assume that people are driven by they're increasing their income and wealth. Incidentally, I think that's not correct. But I think very often that's how it's presented. And then in the common idea that somehow people engaged in the government realm are driven by the common good. Public choice says no. They are driven by their own self-interest, but it might not be maximising their income in wealth. Although sometimes when I look at the French political class, I think it probably is. So what motivates political actors in their behaviour? Well, if you're a politician, what do you want to do? You want to be elected. You want to be in government. How do you do that? You promise goodies to different sectors of society. We'll give more support for the rural areas, or we'll give more support for the old people, or we'll give more support for students. So you win votes not by doing what you think is good for society as a whole. You do it by satisfying special interests within society. Second major group of political actors are bureaucrats, full-time officials. Now, this might not be true in France, because you're so aware, I think, of the importance of les anarches. But in most societies, there's very little attention given to the power of bureaucrats. But it's in the natural self-interest of full-time civil servants to try and increase the power of government. They have more resources, more staff, more power. And the third major group within the political realm are interest groups. And most interest groups, according to the public choice, are driven to try and manipulate government in a way that benefits their particular interests. So, for example, companies trying to protect their industries from foreign competition. Or big corporations who favour new regulations because they can afford to pay the costs of these new regulations, whereas small companies emerging that might end up competing with them can't afford the costs of meeting those regulatory costs. So again, very often the assumption is that business will be against regulation. That's not true. Many regulations, I don't know the examples in France, but many of the regulations in the United States, for example, are suggested by big corporations as a way of reducing their competition. So the problem you have is that you start with the social contract. This is what everybody would reasonably agree on. But instead, government tends to grow and grow. And you end up with the major problem of what the public choice calls concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. That is, the benefits of policies are concentrated in the hands of a few. The costs of those policies are spread among a large number of others. Now, let me give my favourite example. I really, really hate the common agricultural policy of the European Union. The main reason I hate the CAP is because it kills people. That is, there are people in the rest of the world who would like to sell their agricultural products to European consumers, and they're prevented from doing so, and because they cannot sell their products, they die. Now, I happen to be against policies that kill people. But let's ignore that. Let's only think about the context of CAP within the context of the European Union. Roughly, and I don't know the current figure, but roughly about 9% of the population of the European Union is engaged in the agricultural sector. That means 91% are not engaged in the agricultural sector. Now, those who are, they benefit from these policies. They get supports and subsidies. They really care about these policies. What about the 91%? Well, the 91%, they pay more when they go to the shop to buy the goods, and they pay more in taxes to support it. In other words, the vast majority of people are screwed at both ends. They pay higher prices, they pay higher taxes. So you would think, we live in a democracy, or some sort of democracy. Here's a policy which is good for 9% and bad for 91%. Well, obviously the 91% would win and CAP would be ended. But however hard you try, however you do anything about it, it always seems to come back up and attack you. So how do we explain that? The public choice says we explain it by concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. The people who benefit from the common agricultural policy, the 9%, they really, really care about it. They vote for candidates who support it. They campaign for candidates who support it. They throw manure on candidates who don't support it. What about the 91%? Well, they never think about CAP. It never really occurs to them. They don't even understand it, and perhaps don't even know what the acronym stands for. But even if they did, the cost to any particular individual is probably round about 9 or 10 euros a week. Are you going to go to Brussels and bring Brussels to a halt because of the disadvantages of CAP? Whereas we see every year, the beneficiaries of CAP are willing to do that. The public choice school says most government policies are like this. They're not about what's good for the common good. They're about benefiting particular groups within society, what we might call special interests. So the public choice solution, if you like, what is the role of government, is that they believe it is what they sometimes call, I think actually misleadingly, the public goods state. It has two main roles. It has the role of protection, the protective state, the number one role that Chicago talked about, that Freeman talked about. And they have what's called the public goods role, that is dealing with public goods and negative externalities. And a lot of the concern with public choice is how can we prevent the government getting any bigger than this original social contract. So they're very interested in, like, constitutional rules, for example. Can we change the constitution or the rules of the political system to make growing government more difficult? Can we find interest groups who are in favour of less government? So can we organise producers in favour of free trade to counterbalance the power of the protectionist industries? Can we organise taxpayers to lobby against policies which increase taxes? So that's the second thing. Can we find, if you like, pro-limited government interests? And the third thing, solution they're interested in, is can we find political leaders who understand public choice in trying to reduce the role of government? So let me give a classic example of this, was Margaret Thatcher. You know, who recently died, a lot of talk about her, you know, she never changed her position on anything. That's not correct. She wanted to privatise the state-owned industries in the United Kingdom. But she knew that would lead to very strong opposition from those working in those industries. So what she did was, she came up with a policy to give free shares to the people who worked in the state-owned industries, instant wealth, if you like. Then a lot of the opposition, or much of the opposition in those industries, disappeared. She bought off the opposition. Classic case of a political leader who understands these public choice questions and frames their policy not necessarily in the ideal, but in what is politically possible. So this is the second school of thought, the public choice school. about what the role of government and protection and dealing with public choice and negative externalities. The third school I want to look at is Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, and the Austrian school. They're called the Austrian school because the founders came from Austria, but if you go to Austria, you'll almost never find an Austrian, in quotation marks, and nearly all Austrians are in fact Americans. I don't know how many Austrians there are here in France. So it's really about the origins, nothing to do with what is going on in Austria today. I'm here, although I think Hayek and Mises agree on very many things, I want to concentrate on where they disagree with one another. And it begins, I think, with the question of their methodology. How do you decide what the role of government should be? So Hayek's approach is to emphasize the limits of knowledge, what we don't know, to be anti-rationalistic, which is not the same thing as being against reason, but having a lot of faith in traditional values, in common law or customary law traditions. The term that's sometimes used for this is spontaneous order. Because we don't really know, we should give some deference to the existing ways of working. Whereas Ludwig von Mises, another Austrian, has a totally different methodology. He starts from the idea that of what's called a priori deductive reasoning, that is, we can discover the truth or truths, and Mises talked about axioms, which is as another word for truths, we can discover these truths on the basis of reason and reflection. In other words, we can have a much higher degree of knowledge of the world than Hayek suggested. So let me give you a couple of examples of axioms that Mises talks about. The first is that all human action is purposeful, that when people make decisions, they're doing it to create or achieve, I should say, a certain goal. Human action is not random. We can understand why people do what they do. It's not predetermined. We have choices. So all human action is to achieve a purpose. Second type of axiom is that only individuals act. The technical term for this is methodological individualism. So that when we want to understand what's happening, we should look at the specific individuals making that choice. Let me give an example. America was really unhappy at the French government's reaction to their invasion of Iraq. So there was a lot of talk in the United States is we should stop calling it French fries because of the damn French. We should stop buying French wine because of the damn French. But a methodological individualist would say, what did a wine grower have role in deciding what the French government's policy in Iraq was? None. What we should look at is who were the particular individuals within the government who took the position that they did. So in every situation, we should always be asking ourselves, who specifically did this act? And we should avoid just using very general terms. We should look at specific individuals. A third example of an axiom is that value is in the eye of the beholder. The technical term for this is the subjective theory of value. So let me give you an example. I think rap is crap. I think it's really bad music. But there are some bizarre people in this world who seem to like rap. So is this an objective question that we know that Beethoven is so much better than Lady Gaga? Can we say that objectively? Or is it simply that I have a set of values that value one type of music, and some very strange people have a different set of values of what they like? So very often economists are accused of saying that they know the price of everything, but the value of nothing. That assumes that we can discover what the value of something is, that there is an objective value. The Austrians say, no, there is no objective value. The value of something is simply what people think is of value to them. So this is Mises' methodology of trying to decide what government should do. Now, when it comes to the questions about why government should be limited, a lot of it's to do with what's called the knowledge problem, particularly associated with Hayek, but also Mises has his version of it as well. Is that one of the problems is that governments often fail because, one, they cannot know what people really want. They cannot really discover what the values are that people have. People didn't know they wanted the iPad until it was invented. So government couldn't have said, oh, we know people would like something called that we're going to call the iPad. And the other thing, government doesn't know the most effective way of satisfying the wants that people have. That was what was the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed, because you need prices to guide people in making their decisions. So government cannot have the effective knowledge either of people's wants or the best way of achieving people's wants, so we'll always fail. So then what should be the role of the government? Well, Hayek has one very specific standard. It's what he calls the rule of law. He says there are certain standards that we can apply, that should be applied to every government action. So, for example, rules should be general. They should apply to everyone and not simply to some. One reason I think why the French people are so resentful at what they're seeing about their French politicians is that they somehow feel that there's one rule for us and a different rule for others. They're denying the rule of law. That there should be equality before the law, that people should be treated the same regardless of their sex or gender or sexual orientation. Oh, there's something controversial. Sexual orientation. So you should apply the rule of law. You should allow things to happen as long as they meet these criteria of the rule of law. And that leads Hayek to justify something like the social market that the Chicago School endorses. He gets there by a different route, by a different methodology, but roughly he's fairly similar in terms of what the rule of government should be. But Mises, using his methodology, this axioms, he concludes that the role of the state should be a minimal state. That is, the job of the state is only to provide the police, defence, and the courts, and nothing else. So here we have Hayek and Mises, who are Austrians, who share lots of similarities, but they do come to different conclusions about what the role of government should be. Fourth school of thought: Ayn Rand, Robert Nozick, and natural rights. So both of those thinkers, Ayn Rand, popular novelist, I don't know how well known she is here in France, but she's a very popular novelist, been for 40, 50 years. And then Robert Nozick, who was a Harvard philosopher, particularly famous for a book he wrote called Anarchy, State, and Utopia. So they both believe in natural rights, but they get the idea of natural rights from two different places. So Rand says, in her philosophy, which is called Objectivism, she says there is an objective reality, the real world that we can discover, and there's an objective morality that will tell us what is right and what is wrong. And we can discover this objective reality and objective morality by the use of reason. So what we know is it's in the nature of man to live, to exist, to survive. And we know in order to survive, people need to have these natural rights, that they will only survive when natural rights exist. And this is what philosophers call a teleological explanation. It's an explanation, we understand that natural rights exist from the purpose of life, the goal of life. Whereas Robert Nozick, also believing in natural rights, he sees this as it's in our rational self-interest to believe in natural rights. That natural rights are like a form of rules that telling us you shall not do this. It's rather like the Ten Commandments, a set of rules that we should follow. So natural rights are a set of rules that we should follow. And this is called a deontological explanation, that these are moral constraints on what we should and should not do. When it comes to when they look at government, their problem with government is that most of the time, government is violating our rights. All the time, it is violating our rights. It's almost in its nature that it violates our rights. So we need to limit it to prevent it from doing that. And that's why on the third question, they believe in the role of the state is this minimal state. That is, the state has a job to provide the police, the defence and the courts, a minimal state situation. Rand describes this as placing the state under objective control. And Nozick talks about, quote, a minimal state against force, theft, fraud, and the enforcement of contracts is justified. Any more extensive state will violate people's rights. He sometimes uses the rather nice phrase that there should be allowed capitalist acts between consenting adults. So they consume the role of the state is this minimal state role. The fifth, and you'll please know I'm getting close to the end, the fifth school they're going to look at is Murray Rothbard, David Friedman, and anarcho-capitalism. Again, starting with the methodological question, there's a big difference between Murray Rothbard and David Friedman. Friedman is a great believer in natural rights, but is strongly influenced by Mises. And if anybody's interested, I think there's some very interesting differences, because Mises is basically a utilitarian in his approach, a consequentialist, if you like, and Rothbard is a natural rights person. But influenced by Mises-type thinking, Rothbard developed what he called the non-coercive axiom. Remember, axioms is what the Austrian, or what the Mises talked about. So the non-coercive axiom is that it is always wrong to use force or violence or coercion except in self-defense. You should never use violence, never use force, unless you're protecting yourself from someone else. So that's Rothbard's, if you like, methodological approach. Does it meet the non-coercive axiom? Whereas David Friedman, who's Milton Friedman's son, very much adopting his dad's methodology, it's an empirical question. But whereas Milton Friedman says, well, let's compare market failure with government failure, most of the time, government failure is bigger than market failure, so we should leave it to the market. But sometimes we would need the government to intervene in these areas. Whereas David concludes, no, government failure is always worse than market failure. That if you can empirically, if you compare those two, government failure will always be worse. So using a very empirical methodology, very different, as you can see from Mary Rothbard, they belong essentially to the same camp. So on the question about why should the state be limited, on the Rothbard, the classic definition of what is a state comes from Max Weber, who described the state is claims a monopoly of the legitimate use of force over given territory. So coercion is an inherent aspect of the state. It's just that the state says it's all right for us to use force, but not for anyone else. And Rothbard wants to challenge that and saying, so what's so special about the state? The state is simply a very successful monopoly that people allow to exist as a monopoly. So, for example, if someone came along to you and said, so I'm going to say 25%, which is the rough tax rate in the States, it's a lot higher here. If somebody came along to you and said, I am going to take 40% of your income, or 50%, or didn't somebody say 70% of your income? If somebody came along to that, to you, and said, if you don't give me that money, I'm going to put you in a cage, what would we call that person? We would call that person a thief. So Rothbard says, why is it that when something called the state comes along and says, we want to take 70% of your income, and if you don't give it to us, we're going to put you in prison, what gives them the right to do that? They are violating our rights. Indeed, pretty amazingly, even some of your judges thought that it was violating your rights with that proposal. So government should be limited because it violates our rights, according to Rothbard, and according to Friedman, because government is always inefficient compared to the market, we should leave things to the market and not government. And this is what leads them to conclude that what's the role for government? None! That's why they're anarcho-capitalists. They believe there's no role for the state. Instead, everything should be left to voluntary transactions and the market. Because the government is both illegitimate, it has no special rights that we should give it that we would give to any other person, and it's inherently inefficient. It cannot produce the goods that it claims that it can do effectively. There are lots of alternatives that exist. So, for example, in the United States, there are more people employed in private security agencies than are employed by the police. That many social problems, like drug addicts, for example, are more effectively dealt with by civil society, civil organisations, churches, for example, than being left to the state. And there's evidence to show that you don't even need the courts. For example, in international trade, there is no state-run international court deciding on trade disputes. There are private arbitration tribunals that exist to deal with contractual disputes at the international level, which people agree to when they sign their contract. If there is a disagreement, then we will go to these private courts. So the anarcho-capitalists say, we can do the same thing at the national and local level. You don't need state courts. You might need courts, but they could be private courts. And they say particularly to their minimal state friends, you say the minimal state is ideal, but as soon as you have a state, it will creep up and will get bigger and bigger and bigger. You can't keep it limited. It's always going to be much bigger than you really want it to be. So, sorry, I covered a lot of ground. Five different schools of thought. So, come back to the three questions. I think the interesting question is, what's your criteria for deciding what the role of government should be? What's your philosophy, your methodology? Second question, why do you think that government should be limited? Is it because of the consequences of government actions, they should be limited? Or do you think government should be limited because it's a threat to our natural rights? And the third question is, what do you think the role of government should be? Should it be none? Minimal state? Public good state? Social market economy? Or something else? You know, do you think it's the job of the state to promote virtue? Is it the job of the state to promote equality? Is there a bigger role from the state than any of the libertarians that we talked about? So, sorry, I know that was a difficult talk to follow in English for such a long time, but I hope it gave you some things to think about. I think what we're going to do now is to begin by saying, if anybody has any questions they want to ask in terms of clarification, was there something I said that they did not understand? And then, I don't know, we may have time now, but if not, after the buffet, what I'd like to do then is to get people to say what they feel about these questions. So not just a question and answer to me, although I'm happy to take questions, but I actually think it's more productive for you to have a discussion amongst yourselves about what you think about the questions I've raised. And as I said, ideally from my point of view, it would be nice if you're able to express them in English, but if you're not able to express them in English, you're happy to express it in French. Thank you so very much for listening. So does anybody have any question of clarification? Something I said that... Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Maybe I was asleep, but I think you didn't say anything about the School of Natural Rights.
About?
The School of Natural Rights.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I haven't heard you about this.
Oh, so that was in the context of Ayn Rand and Robert Nozick. So both of them believing in natural rights. What I didn't do is talk about what natural rights are.
Yes.
And what sort of limits they would place. I would say life, liberty, and property is what I would describe as natural rights. Incidentally, always remind if you have any discussion about the United Nations, that the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights mentions property as a basic human right, and the United Nations never talks about property. But I think natural rights are life, liberty, and property, what they're necessary for a person to exist. And again, I'm not necessarily defending natural rights or saying it's correct, but I think that's the conception that both Rand and Nozick would say is what natural rights are.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other clarification? Yeah. Oh, no.
My question would be more on the structure of your presentation. I would like to know what is the interest today to do such maybe a traditional presentation between all the schools. What can we learn from that, and where are we today? Which is the most influential school today maybe we can note? And does it mean we need to choose? You know what I mean?
Or right. Yeah. Well, I'm more interested in what we think is the truth or the correct view, rather than necessarily what's the most influential view. So I'm interested in you thinking about what your views on these particular questions. So I don't care if you're the only person in the world who believes what you believe, as long as you've thought about it, thought about alternatives, and come to the conclusion, no, this is the correct view. So I'm not sort of interested in a sort of popularity contest on this question. In terms of what the value of this, I realise that this is not a policy prescription for saving France. It doesn't tell you, here are the six things you need to do to save France. If that's what you want, I ain't going to give it to you. In terms of what's the most influential, that's really a question about how wide you want to raise it. Because I would say that probably the Milton Friedman, Chicago School, consequentialist approach is the one that you're most likely to hear in public discussion. If they're looking at, for example, policies, are the consequences going to be good or bad? One of my concerns about that, though, is I do think there is this perception that liberals only really care about material things, that they're too economistic in their approach, that they don't have any morality. So that when there is a debate, let's say there is a debate, for example, about the environment, and on the one side the liberals talk about the costs of a new regulations, environmental regulations, that seems very materialistic, while the Greens are saying we need to protect the environment for the future and for our children, when that is the debate, it seems to me that the liberals will always lose. We need to demonstrate that we too care about these values, in this case the environment, but we believe that free market solutions are more superior than government solutions to environmental problems. And there's a whole school of thought out there on free market environmentalism. In fact, there is a isn't there a French group that works on this? You think remember what it is? No, don't worry. I thought there was a group that works on French, a French group that works on free market environmental questions. So we must be careful that we don't turn it into money on one side, on our side, and moral values on the other. If that's how it's perceived, then I think morality will always trump French francs. So although I do believe that it's the consequentialist Chicago-type approach which is the most widespread among libertarians, in the end I don't think that's going to be enough to win the liberal cause.
Thank you. Speaking about that difference between consequentialist approaches and what you call theological or deontological approaches, mm-hmm. do you think it is a meaningful distinction?
Oh.
And if yes, why doesn't it appear on your table that captures all the different flavors of libertarianism?
Well, sorry, let's get the until it comes back. So I think the big debate is between the consequentialists and the natural rights people. I think on the table it sort of mentions whether they're consequentialist or whether there's a natural rights approach. That strikes me as the really big debate between the two. And so that's the question, is when you approach these questions, are you more of a consequentialist or more of a natural rights person? This may be a really bad thing to say, but let me say, I'm a consequentialist defender of natural rights. What I mean by that is, I don't believe that you can philosophically prove that natural rights exist. But I think there's a good deal of empirical evidence that shows that those societies which act as if there's such a thing as natural rights are more successful and better societies than those that don't. In other words, that's what I think of as a consequentialist defence of natural rights. And that will probably upset both the consequentialists and the natural rights people. Was there somewhere? Another? Yeah.
Thank you. I would have a technical question for you. You mentioned several times in your speech the notion of market failure. And I was wondering whether there was a consensual definition of this notion. Because I think it's very vague and prone to every kind of manipulation. Because it seems to create the idea that every time there's a disorder in the market, it creates a legitimate basis for the state to intervene.
I better wait for the mic now. Well, here I think we have to make a distinction between the way market failure is used in like more popular means, like, for example, in the media, which is used extremely loosely, and the way in which economists talk about market failure, which is, I think, public goods and negative externalities. So I think there is a clear definition of what they are, but it's understood amongst economists. It's not widely understood among the public at large, or, dare I say it, by journalists who supposedly explain economics in the media, let alone the politicians who are supposed to be thinking about these sorts of questions. So I think there is a clear conception, but it's not one that's well understood. It's used too widely instead of narrowly. But I think one of the interesting questions, though, is the debate about, well, how extensive are public goods and negative externalities? So the Chicago School, I think, tends to have a relatively extensive view about what these might be, at least among libertarians, and others might have a more narrow view about what they are. So Austrians, for example, argue that many of the things that the Chicago School call market failures are not market failures, they're not public good problems, they're not negative externality questions. The thing that really interests me is the question of to what extent can technology change what used to be a public good, what used to be a negative externality, can now be something that the market can deal with. There's a great book, if anyone's interested in this, about how technology is changing what used to be market failures we didn't seem to have a good solution to, that now we can. A classic case would be roads. It was argued that it's very difficult for the market to provide roads, but now we can put little things on cars. As you get, I'm not a technology person. We can put things on cars, and that when you drive through, it will say, you know, I've driven 20 miles on this particular road, so therefore I have to pay a certain number of francs. So technology may make it easier to find market solutions to some of these market failure questions. But the other thing I'd also emphasise is that even if we acknowledge that these market failure exists, that doesn't mean that government knows how to solve it. So it may be that we're going to have to live in a world where there are these market failures, because we don't know how to solve them, and that specifically government can't solve them. And if government does try to solve them, it has all these negative unintended consequences. So market failure might not be such a big problem as it's often presented. Anyone?
Thank you. Sorry for my language.
Don't worry, your English will be much better than my French.
Could you re-explain the position of Murray Rothbard and David Friedman about justice?
Oh, about justice.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. So the question is, why do you need, well, by justice, do you mean courts, or do you mean more broadly than that?
Courts, yes.
Yeah. So the court, why do you need courts? Is the sort of the big question. Why? You need courts because people may be in conflict with one another, and how can we make sure they peacefully resolve those conflicts? Well, what they're saying is government does a really bad job of exercising justice, of dealing with conflicts. Again, I don't know what it's like in France, but very often you may have a court case and it lasts years and years and years before it gets resolved. So many, many private business. And so the example I gave was at the international level, that there's no international contract court, for example, it's done by private arbitration. That you can have the same thing is increasingly happening, at least in the United Kingdom and some other countries, where national businesses who are dealing in contracts with each other, because they're so fed up with the fact that it takes so long to go through the state courts, it takes so long to, so expensive to go through the state courts, that they will agree, even inside their own country, to agree in advance to go to a private arbitration council. So it's argued that there are ways in which private courts can do a better way, a more efficient job than others. I don't get too much into the sort of the details of it, the weeds, as Americans would say. But what they, what Murray Rothbard argues, is that most people would belong to something they call a private protection agency. The job of this private protection agency is that when you do come into conflict with another person, for example, somebody stealing something from you, you have this agency, which may look something vaguely like a private police force, if you like. Their job is to make sure that that person is caught and is your goods are returned to you. And what you would have is that people, these private protection agencies, would compete for your business. So there wouldn't be one monopoly, the state that provides this particular protection. There will be a series of different agencies that would do it. And then consumers would decide which one gave the best package to each other. And then when there was a conflict between two people, it would be resolved between the two private protection agencies. And they have an incentive to find a peaceful and relatively costless way of coming to agreements between each other. I'm not saying I buy this. I'm just explaining that this is how they believe would occur. So they recognize you need protection, but they say the government does a really lousy job of it. If we think that competition is good in everything else, why don't we think it's good when it comes to the court system?
I suggest to have a break
now. Yeah, c'est bon.
And the second session after the buffet. We have 15 minutes before the buffet. Thank you, Nigel. Thank you very much. Donc en français, donc on a un petit quart d'heure. Vous pouvez aller voir les livres. Hein, nous avons...